This is WJBC This Week.
Any loss of life is horrible, whether it's us, citizen, anybody. But this was very tragic and very horrific.
There's still a distrust for law enforcement, you know, among the African-American community. And it's something that needs to be worked on.
He said in his recitation of what occurred that she violated law.
We're a step above anyone else around us. But for living in Illinois.
Welcome to WJBC This Week, where we look back at the top stories and interviews from the past week. I'm Eric Stock. On this week's program, we have reaction locally from the deadliest incident against police in the United States since the 9/11 terror attacks, the killing of five police officers and the wounding of nine other people in Dallas. We get two perspectives from Bloomington's police chief and the head of the local NAACP. A gun instructor trains teens on how to avoid using a weapon. Wounded Vietnam veteran turned activist and author Ron Kovic shares his personal experiences with the veterans medical care. Plus, the director of the Illinois State University Planetarium tells us what the Juno space probe to Jupiter might find. That and more coming up. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. The fatal shooting of five Dallas police officers and the wounding of seven other officers and two civilians, an apparent response to the protests spurred by videos where two African-American men were shot by police in Louisiana and Minnesota, raised the issue of rising tensions between police and the public, especially where race is involved. We got reaction from the president of the Bloomington Normal NAACP, Quincy Cummings. He talked with WJBC's Terry James this week.
Two shootings this week of black men by white police officers and then the incident in Dallas. Your reaction?
Well, I'll structure my response this way. The two shootings in Louisiana and Minnesota, totally reprehensible. This is a problem that's starting to grow like cancer, and it shows that we have people on the force that shouldn't be there. If they can't rely on their training to get through situations such as a traffic stop or an encounter on the street, then they need to hang up their badge, plain and simple. You know, police officers are trained to deal with situations like this, and if police officers are dead by fear instead, and they need to turn in their gun and badge, plain and simple. Speaking on the Dallas issue, I watched it on the news last night and was horrified, because what it looks like is that the violence is begetting violence. You know, in no way do I condone the shooting of any police officer. You know, police officers are to, you know, protect and serve. And this is what happens when people start to believe that the police are doing the opposite.
When we're talking about the African Americans that you have personally spoke with, do they feel safe around police?
Well, the best way to answer that question is that most do not. Even though that we're making strides in the community with the relationship with police, there's still a distrust for law enforcement, you know, among the African-American community. And it's something that needs to be worked on, because if not, then, you know, we're a police shooting away from having the same thing happen in Bloomington. You know, so we have to continue to work together and build that trust with the community. And, you know, in the branch, as you know, has been trying to do that. Along with Matt, you know, a situation like this, the best response I have is that everybody loses. When there's no trust in law enforcement, people get hurt. You know, when law enforcement don't trust the community, people get hurt. And we're starting to see this happen far too often. It's got to stop. I don't know if it's addressed through training. I don't know if this is addressed through training. I don't know. I don't know how to solve this problem. I think it's going to take more than the NAACP, and I think it's just going to take a total, full community approach to this. You know, but I mean, how many more interviews do we have to have like this? You know, how many situations do we have to respond to? You know, where this is happening. This is totally preventable.
Mr. Cummings, I keep hearing that 99% of police are good, trustworthy people. It's just that 1%. Do you believe that's true?
I believe there are more good cops than there are bad. I do that. But, you know, I was speaking with someone this morning, and he made a good point that, you know, you have these bully cops that make it bad on everyone else, you know, that, you know, and, you know, these bad apples that need to be, you know, pulled out because, you know, their attitudes and their beliefs and the way they do things, you know, are infectious, and they influence other officers to be the same. So, yeah, I believe 99% of police officers are good, well-meaning individuals who want to do the best job for their community and the people in it. But, you know, but we got to root out that 1%, you know, that have personal vendettas.
Let me get your response to this. I heard that this was on a nightly news program, but I heard that an African American man, was talking to his son and saying that you must do whatever you're told by police, even if it violates your civil rights, in order to not be harmed.
Well, I think, you know, I've heard a lot of parents having conversations with their sons to do exactly that. You know, and it's unfortunate. It's unfortunate that I have to, and I don't have children, but it's unfortunate for me to face having to tell my nephew to do what he's told, even though it might be violating his rights, in order to make it home. But, you know, the other way that I address that question is that when there's an encounter with police and you feel like your rights have been violated, you have to complain. You have to go and complain. And that is one thing that we see in the community a lot, is that when things happen like this, people do not complain. How can we impress upon police to do the right thing if people do not speak out and complain? So I think it ought to be balanced. Yes, you need to comply with what the officer is asking you to do. You have to do that because, unfortunately, you know, they are in the position of power in that situation. But if you feel that your rights have been violated, then we have to stand up as a community and make that known to our local law enforcement, because if not, then the same thing continues to happen and nothing changes.
That was Quincy Cummings, president of the Bloomington Normal NAACP, with Terry James. And the killing of five police officers in Dallas was the latest incident in what's become a rising trend. 13 police officers have been killed by gunfire this year, which is nearly double the rate from the last 2 years. Bloomington Police Chief Brendan Hefner talked with WJBC's Susan Saunders this week.
Is this something that shakes you, or is this becoming an everyday understanding and you just deal with it like another workday?
Well, obviously we deal with different types of incidents that occur like this, and officers do lose their lives at times, be it crashes, be it acts of violence, things of this nature. But this is probably the most tragic, as it was obviously a planned event, a planned ambush, and that is not the norm. Any loss of life is horrible, whether it's us, citizen, anybody. But this was very tragic and very horrific.
And very specific.
Yes, in the manner that it occurred. So obviously in my position, I do not see all the officers. I had sent a note out regarding, we know that people's sensitivities are heightened, mm-hmm, over the events that occurred earlier this week.
In Minnesota, down in Louisiana, we understand that.
We have to remain professional and understand that. And we hope that people express themselves in a peaceful manner, but then you have people doing cowardly things trying to take advantage of people who have the right to go out and protest in a peaceful manner. And that is what is really, really disheartening about the whole thing, is that, you know, this cowardly act, it didn't help anything. It actually drew attention away from the message that people were trying to convey, obviously. So it's just very tragic. But as I said, I don't see my officers all the time, but I will tell you, in law enforcement, as guardians, if they think that this is going to dissuade us or stop us from doing our job, they are very wrong.
Earlier this year, you and I were talking about the hardships as well as the pleasantries of trying to recruit new people into employment as police officers. We were looking for more diversification, you know, in police officers. We'd like to see more people of color, more women, a lot more diversity so that people feel like they're represented by their own kind in the police force in a variety of ways. And yet we didn't see as many people coming from different backgrounds applying, even in the first of the many steps that you have to go through to be a police officer. Are you worried about future recruitment being even more difficult now, seeing that in the last 2 years we have seen the largest numbers of police officer deaths in the United States than we ever have in history? It used to be in the neighborhood of 35 to 40 a year, still too many. Last year it was 144.
Yes, that does certainly cause us concern. The attitudes of some towards police officers, that affects recruitment also. But even without that, this is not a job that everyone can do. So we will continue to hit it hard. The good people, the right people who want to come out, as you see in our posters, make a difference. That is what you are truly trying to do. You're trying to make a difference in your community by helping in your community. You know, we help way more people than we ever arrest. We assist people. We help them with far more things than what people would ever understand. And only by being a police officer do you truly understand that. People see certain things, but, you know, people forget. Somebody's out there at midnight working in the rain or in the cold, helping someone whose car is broken down or helping somebody in need get to where they need to get. In the worst conditions, we're 24/7.
I've never understood how a person can be trained to not think of themselves and their own safety first, to think of others first, because your human instinct is to not die. Your human instinct is to protect yourself. And yet police officers, as well as firefighters and military members, are trained to think of others first and work for a crowd. We have so many giant events that happen, not just protests of like what happened in Dallas last night, but we have parades. We have, you know, positive festivals and fairs where police officers work security for those events. Do you worry that some of your staff are going to be looking over their shoulder to see if they're being targeted instead of looking out over the crowd to protect them?
Well, if we're going to be targeted, more likely it would be someone from in the crowd. So that's part of what we do. And in regards to what we do, that's why we train. That's why we train so hard, because you can't think. We're trained to react, and your training kicks in. And, you know, maybe afterwards you consider some things, but when you're trained right, you react and your training kicks in. And that's what we have to rely on. That's why training is so important.
That was Bloomington Police Chief Brendan Heffner with Susan Saunders. Before Illinois became the last state of the country to make the concealed carrying of a gun legal, there were fewer than 100 licensed weapons instructors in the state. Today, there are well over 3,000. So many, in fact, the one based in Champaign is holding a training that deals with protection that goes far beyond the use of guns. In fact, it helps to train teens on what to do to de-escalate some difficult situations. John Bach, director of Guns Save Life, talked with WJBC this week.
Teenagers aren't carrying guns on a daily basis by a long shot, certainly the law-abiding ones. And so we want to give them some tricks and techniques they can use to, first of all, identify and avoid confrontations. But if it should happen, for instance, we're going to have a local Krav Maga instructor, Bill Martin, who teaches at the workout company in Normal. He's going to come and give the kids some basic simple techniques and strategies they can use to escape somebody choking them or grabbing them, doing those sorts of things to counter those sorts of things for young people so that they can escape somebody trying to grab them and abduct them or to choke them or to otherwise physically attack them. You know, if the worst happens and they can't avoid a situation, they'll at least have some strategies they can use at that point to, as I say, physically resist.
With their bare hands.
Exactly. Absolutely. There will be a small firearms component in there because we recognize that these kids may find themselves at some point in their lives in a home or an establishment where a handgun's available to them, and give them some basic fundamentals on how to use that. But the class is primarily on identifying and avoiding trouble and confrontations as opposed to using deadly force to resist them.
You've done programs of training like this in the past, as I understand, but the focus has shifted just a little bit because of concealed carry. There are so many courses like that across the state where you can have training specifically on handling a weapon.
Yeah, there's all kinds of concealed carry classes all across Illinois now. We've got 3,300 instructors here in Illinois, up from 42 the year before we had concealed carry here in Illinois. This class is geared towards kind of a different audience. In addition to doing concealed carry training for 20 years to law-abiding citizens, we've also taught for many years the pistol component of the longest-running NRA youth shooting camp here in Darnell's in Bloomington. And that class, in fact, is going to be the weekend after our personal protection for teens class, and that whole weekend will be out at Darnell's helping young people learn the fundamentals of pistol craft. But this class, the personal protection for teens, is again more towards teaching kids how to avoid situations and to some tactics and techniques they can use to save lives instead of becoming victims.
How do you explain this to a parent who might think, I don't want my child in any kind of potentially hostile situation, of course, but the idea of guns or weapons or anything like that just puts them in a place where they don't want to go?
Well, some parents feel that way, and they're absolutely right to raise their kids to whatever set of standards and beliefs they want to. However, with decisions come consequences. By denying the potential threats out there in the real world, they aren't educating their children in how to deal with those potential threats, to identify them, to deal with them, to manage them, and increasing the risk to their own children. But, you know, again, it's a parental decision of whether or not they want to educate their kids. And this isn't for young people who are immature who are squeamish. This is a class for kids that are mature or for young people going off to college another giant gun-free zone. Give them some tools and techniques they can use to, again, identify potential trouble before it becomes a problem and to take themselves out of the situation, because the best way to win a confrontation is to not be there.
How do you know? I guess maybe if you're a parent, you either know or you don't whether your child is going to be comfortable in this kind of a setting.
Well, again, this is a parental thing. It's sort of like, at what age do you begin to drown-proof your children? And what age do you begin to teach your children about fire safety and water safety? And this is hot, don't touch it. This is kind of analogous to some of that sort of education that parents can give their children. And we will teach them some more advanced tactics and techniques, things like pre-violence indicators, pre-incident cues, and all kinds of things like this. So when these young people see these things in real life, they can go, aha, something's very amiss here. I need to get away from whatever this potential problem or situation brewing is. And that's, again, the best way to avoid a confrontation. And these young people are going to be, as they get older into the college age, they're going to be at parties, they're going to be at bars. And these pre-assault cues and indicators and incident indicators, these things are going to happen at bars and parties as well, just as they happen down there, I have no doubt, at the nightclub in Orlando. You know, if these people had been aware of their situation and their surroundings just a little bit more, they could have potentially extracted themselves from a situation. You know, you see somebody walking into a club like that and they start to shoot, you know, a lot of people will instinctively just freeze. That's the last time you want to freeze. You want to be running for your life out the door, and you want to be bringing along as many other innocents as you can on your way. But again, it's about paying attention to your surroundings and what's going on around you, and not being in condition white or oblivious to your surroundings when you're out in public. That's how you stay safe.
That was John Bach of Guns Save Life on WJBC. The Personal Protection for Teens training is next Saturday and Sunday at the DeWitt Sportsman's Club in Clinton. Today's local news is next. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Ron Kovic joined the Marines out of high school in 1964. 4 years later, he was left paralyzed in his second tour of duty in Vietnam, which started a long and troubled journey for him to get the care he and many of his comrades in battle needed. He wrote the memoir called Born on the 4th of July. None other than Bruce Springsteen provided a new foreword to the 40th anniversary edition this week. Kovic has a follow-up memoir called Hurricane Street. Kovic talked with WJBC's Steve Fast this week.
Obviously, you've been in and out of care, especially at the VA and Army hospitals.
Initially, I was in the intensive care ward in Da Nang. After being wounded, actually, I was shot in the front of my foot, and the bullet blew out the back of my heel. And then, that's about a minute later, I was shot in the right shoulder, went through my right lung, collapsed my lung, severed my spine, paralyzing me from the mid-chest down. The first Marine who tried to save my life came up from behind and was almost immediately shot in the heart, and he died within seconds. A few minutes later, a second Marine grabbed a hold of me, came up from behind under heavy fire, carried me back somehow, making it both of us back to our lines without getting hit. And that was the last I saw of him. And I eventually was moved back across a river, the Quabiet River, where I received my first medical attention. Then I was sent a helicopter, a UE medevac chopper to, I think it was Dong Ha, and then I caught a flight C-130 down to, with other wounded Marines, to Da Nang. I was in the Da Nang intensive care ward for a week. Initially, I was given the last rites of the Catholic Church. They didn't know if I was going to make it or not, and I made it through those 7 days in and out of morphine. I was sent to the Yokosuka Naval Hospital in Japan for about a week, maybe 10 days. And then I began that long journey with other wounded young men back to Alaska, then Virginia, then up to Long Island, where initially I was at the St. Albans Naval Hospital on Long Island with wounded Marines. And then after 7 months, that was the spring of 1968, I actually can clearly remember, while still at St. Albans Naval Hospital on Long Island recovering, Martin Luther King. It was, I believe it was April 4th, 1968. He was shot and killed on the balcony of the Lorraine Motel in Memphis. I remember that clearly. It was not long after that I was sent to the Bronx VA Hospital, to the paraplegic ward, and it was very different than what I had experienced in the St. Albans military hospital. The wards were overcrowded, understaffed, men cried out for help and never came. As depicted in Born on the 4th of July movie and my book as well, there were rats on the ward. And in fact, Life magazine did a very shocking expose of the spinal cord injury wards at the Bronx VA entitled Our Forgotten Wounded, the May 1970 Life magazine article, which was quite controversial at the time. So that was the ward I was on in particular. Eventually, I left that hospital, and I got a hand-control car. I went through about 11 months of rehab, as most of us who were paralyzed did. And after about a year or so of trying to go to college on Long Island, I was very restless. I was dealing with anxiety attacks, nightmares, a lot of stress, or they would call it PTSD today, combat-related stress. And I moved out to California, where I began going to the, as an outpatient basis, the Long Beach VA Hospital, which I was surprised to discover was as bad, if not worse at the time, than the Bronx VA in New York. So we had problems.
You mentioned that you thought that perhaps things would be better at the VA out in Long Beach.
Yeah, exactly. You know, when I moved out to California, I thought to myself, you know, 3,000 miles, warm, sunshine, it's got to be better than, you know, the hospital here has got to, you know, it's so far away from the Bronx, that can't be repeating itself. But as I was to find out, it was repeating itself back then in many VA hospitals around the country. Many veterans were dealing with a government that could, at the time, seem to be able to spend more money on some of the most expensive weapons of war and not be able to care for their most severely injured upon their return home from war. It was quite ironic.
We're talking with Ron Kovic. He is the author of a memoir that you've probably heard of, Born on the 4th of July. He has a new book, Hurricane Street, which, Ron, you know, we're about to touch upon the Long Beach VA and how your surprise of the condition of these VA hospitals led you to an incident that made national news in 1974.
It was really amazing because we had nothing really to speak of. You know, we had no contacts. We were in a VA hospital in the spinal cord injury ward. I found myself back on the ward. I had a bed sore, which is really one of the challenges of being a paraplegic, trying to avoid having your skin break down. It's a very complex challenge, whether it's the catheter with inside of you so you can go to the bathroom, trying not to have an infection, or, you know, you're battling with this all the time. And it's really a challenging wound and a challenging disability. And let's set the stage for what was going on during that period. The war was ending. Actually, that was just the beginning of Watergate as well. President Nixon mm-hmm. was under a great deal of pressure to resign, and he would eventually resign in August of that year. But this was the spring of 1974, and the war was ending, and the wounded were coming home, and we were all in our early 20s. In this particular place, we were in the Long Beach VA spinal cord injury wards, and we were quadriplegics, paraplegics, as I said before, some of the most catastrophic wounds of the war, and we were just trying to make it through each day. There was a whole feeling of defeat, a feeling the war had been lost, and why did I sacrifice my body? What was this all about? And not only that, but the treatment on the wards was particularly insensitive. There were problems on the ward, and what we decided to do, we first started talking with a group of paralyzed veterans in back of the paraplegic ward, but eventually we formed a group called the Patient Workers' Rights Committee, and we began to get more and more people from not only the SCI, spinal cord injury ward, but from all over the hospital that began to join us. And within a few weeks, we had between 100 and 150 veterans in back of the paraplegic wards every Thursday night gathering together and discussing the problems that we were experiencing in the VA. Well, the powers that be at the hospital at that time didn't like it. They sent around the security representatives, and they were actually photographing us. It was quite intimidating for veterans back from a war who only wanted to talk about improving their condition in the hospital to be photographed by people as if we were committing some type of crime. Well, eventually I left the hospital, and the group that we formed fell apart. And when I returned back to California after spending a summer in New York, I began to put together an idea, which eventually became the American Veterans Movement. I went out and got a bunch of buttons and banners and flags. I did it on what I should have been using for my monthly rent on Hurricane Street, because I was living along the ocean at the time in Marina Del Rey in Southern California. I was living on Hurricane Street, a little cottage along the ocean, and the idea was I was going to come back to California and write my first book, which I did not write, but was the first attempt to write Born on the 4th of July. But instead, I started writing late one night when I couldn't write the book anymore, and I started thinking about the guys in the hospital. I thought, you know, I had promised them I would never let them down, and so I created this American Veterans Movement, drove down to the hospital, organized the guys, and got them, if but reluctantly, to come with me to create a caravan down to the federal building in Los Angeles. And we caravaned down there with our hand-controlled cars and our wheelchairs. And what we did was we initially planned to meet with Senator Cranston, who was a senator from California at the time, and he was also the head of a very important hospital committee, VA Hospital Committee in Washington, and he was up for re-election. And so we decided to begin a sit-in the first day we were there. We're just going to sit in there for a few hours. Well, we ended up spending the entire night there. Senator Cranston was very supportive. He was in Washington at the time. He sent over blankets and mattresses. He actually sent over food for that night from the Westwood VA Food Services Department. And so we had a good night. But the next morning, all the guys left, with the exception of myself and one other wounded veteran. And on that particular night, when there were just two of us left and it looked like everything was going to fall apart, we decided to call up the press, call up the Associated Press, the UPI, and tell them that we're going on a hunger strike to the death. Those are the exact words we used. We're two Vietnam veterans, and we're going on a hunger strike to the death to protest the poor treatment in not only the Long Beach VA hospital, but in VA hospital facilities all over the country. We demand to be treated like human beings. And that was what we said that night. And to my surprise, the next morning, the press was everywhere. They were calling. And by that night, the guys who had left initially and gone back after that first night all had seen us on TV, had heard about us on the radio. They came back in their wheelchairs. They joined us. They committed themselves to the fast, to the hunger strike. And we went 17 days without food, and we occupied Senator Cranston's office for 19 days, demanding to meet with Donald Johnson, the head of the VA, and eventually he was forced to come out and meet with us. But let me say one thing, and that's, as I look back upon it, as I'm turning 70 years old on the 4th of July, this Monday, and as I look back upon that incident 40 years ago, I can't help but think how absurd it was. And if you can imagine, some of the most severely wounded veterans who really were willing to sacrifice themselves for this country, laying on a senator's office on mattresses, sacrificing themselves once again in a hunger strike, going on a hunger strike, just asking to be treated decently. I mean, that's unconscionable. That should have never happened in this country of ours.
That was Vietnam veteran, author, and activist Ron Kovic with Steve Fast. You can hear the entire interview at WJBC.com. NASA's Juno space probe arrived on the giant planet of Jupiter this week. Director of the Illinois State University Planetarium, Tom Wilmich, talked about what the goal of the space probe mission is and what it might teach us about other planets when he talked with WJBC's Patty Penn this week.
What do you think we will find out? I know water is a big concern this time, or something that they're really going to try to look at, correct?
Right. What they're looking for is the abundance of oxygen in the atmosphere of Jupiter. And with that, well, you have water. And so water is certainly a big concern. One of the really big things with this mission is trying to understand the deep structure of Jupiter. And one of the big mysteries that was left unsolved by Galileo, the Galileo probe, is whether or not there's a small rocky Earth-size core, for a rocky core, at the center of Jupiter. We don't know. It could be gaseous throughout, or it could have this rocky core. And to get a sense of the size of Jupiter, you have to remember, it would take 11 Earths in a row to span the face of Jupiter. And if Jupiter were hollow, it would hold nearly 1,400 planet Earths. So this thing is massive. By understanding that deep structure, it gives us a far greater understanding of Jupiter. It helps us understand how Jupiter formed, and in turn, it helps us understand how all the planets in the solar system, including our Earth, formed long ago.
So with that being said, if there's no core, what does that mean then? What is at the center?
Well, it could be that it has simply a liquid. It might have the core might be gaseous, but it would be hydrogen in a gaseous form that's really the equivalent of a liquid metal. So it's really amazing. One way or another, this is an amazing planet.
It is absolutely beautiful, as you said. And one of the things we do keep hearing about is, even in the situation with these little Lego aluminum figures, the heat that is involved is something that they've had to consider. Can you speak to that? Is it temperature-wise hotter in this particular region?
Well, as you get deeper into the clouds of Jupiter, the temperature, of course, rises as the pressure rises. Now, the probe's not going to sail down into there, but what's happening, Jupiter has just powerful radiation fields, and those radiation belts would fry the electronics on almost any kind of space probe you might send there. Yeah, with Juno, though, they actually built this massive titanium housing. The thing, it's the size of a small shed, and the probe is massive, or it's huge, I should say. It's 60 foot across. It has these three large solar panels, and unlike many of the previous space missions, say New Horizons just last year, those spacecraft were nuclear powered. They had small nuclear reactors that generated the electricity that powered the space probes. With Juno, it's actually a solar-powered probe. But getting back to it again, where the instruments are, that housing is armored in titanium, and it's especially designed to withstand the radiation from Jupiter's powerful radiation belts. And even so, it can't Juno can't spend a lot of time down in that sea of radiation. The plan is for the space probe to dip down for several hours, once every 2 weeks or so, study the planet a little bit closer than the rest of the time, and then rise back up out of those radiation belts again. And at that point, we'll study the Jupiter from afar for a bit until the next dive down into the radiation belts. But we're swooping down and taking, you know, this amazing glimpse, and even things like the radiation belts themselves, the powerful magnetic fields, the aurora, and there's actually one of the things that Galileo and even the Voyager space probes before Galileo discovered is there's these magnificent auroras, the northern and southern lights that Jupiter has. Those will be studied in particular by Juno. It's actually one of the mission goals. So, you know, again, just we're going to gather a wealth of information on this most magnificent of the planets in our solar system. And with that understanding, we can then relate that back to our planet Earth.
That was ISU Planetarium Director Tom Wilmich with Patty Penn. The Weekend News is next. This WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Time now for the weekend news. The head of the Bloomington Normal NAACP, Quincy Cummings, says a distrust remains between Black Americans and the police.
Even though that we're making strides in the community with the relationship with police, there's still a distrust for law enforcement, you know, among the African American community. And it's something that needs to be worked on, because if not, then, you know, we're a police shooting away from having the same thing happen in Bloomington.
Cummings is reacting to incidents in Louisiana, Minnesota, which preceded the fatal shooting of five Dallas police officers amid peaceful protests. Cummings says the problem of Black men being killed by white police officers is a problem that is growing like a cancer. Congressman Darren LaHood says he's disappointed that Attorney General Loretta Lynch and the FBI Director James Comey did not pursue charges against former Secretary of State and presumptive Democratic presidential nominee Hillary Clinton over her use of personal email to handle classified information.
I wish he would have taken this case to the grand jury. The reason why we have a grand jury process is for them to decide on whether there are criminal violations that occurred, and for the grand jury to then decide to go forward with charges. That didn't happen here.
The Peoria Republican says Clinton may not be headed to court, but says she already faces added scrutiny in the court of public opinion. LaHood calls Clinton's actions as Secretary of State disingenuous and, even worse, unethical. The state of Illinois could be one of the biggest hurdles facing local leaders trying to find a new buyer for the old Mitsubishi Motors plant in Normal. It's not that state regulators are stopping the sale. The state's reputation could be. Kyle Hamm of the Bloomington Normal Economic Development Council says there's interest in the plant, but
we're a step above anyone else around us but for living in Illinois. And that's what I hear constantly from people looking to do business here.
Ham says any new buyer is looking for similar subsidies, but knows it can't get anywhere near $280 million. Ham says there's an urgency to find a new buyer before the current owner scraps it for parts. Bloomington's legal victory over cutting back sick leave buyback benefits for the city's firefighters has been upheld. The 4th District Appeals Court in Springfield ruled the city had the legal authority to reduce maximum payouts for future firefighters to help reduce the city's unfunded pension liability, which at the time approached $38 million. And McLean County's efforts to improve mental health care has earned it a seat at the table for a National Justice Department initiative. County officials have been taking part in two teleconferences each week for 5 months with the members of the White House's Data-Driven Justice Initiative, an effort to provide better care for the mentally ill.
What we've learned, and I think now recognize, is that this just isn't a local problem. And I wasn't sure about that 3 years ago.
McLean County Administrator Bill Wasson says the initiative demonstrates the county has many of the assets needed to provide care for the mentally ill, but that it requires coordination between healthcare, law enforcement locally, and technology firms that can help streamline that communication to give first responders the information they need to assist the mentally ill. Up next, the week to come. This WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. It's time to take a look ahead at the week to come. On Monday night, the local Not in Our Town movement will hold a vigil in downtown Bloomington at First Christian Church to mourn the shooting victims in Dallas, Minnesota, and Louisiana. Bloomington's City Council will take a first look at the preliminary draft of the city's 5-year capital improvement plan. Also Monday, a Bloomington man, Deontay Jordan, scheduled to stand trial on charges in connection with the shooting in December of 2014. On Tuesday, it's baseball's Midsummer Classic, the All-Star Game in San Diego. On Wednesday, Connect Transit will host a public hearing at Uptown Station in Normal on its proposed rate change. On Wednesday night, Wounded Warrior Shiloh Harris will share his survival story in a moving presentation at the DoubleTree Hotel and Conference Center in Bloomington. Also Wednesday, 6 Normal Cornbelters will take part in the Frontier League All-Star Game in Florence, Kentucky. This has been WJBC This Week. To listen to this week's program again, go to the WJBC.com podcast page. I'm Eric Stock.